I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The championship season is over, and what a season it was.
But the best is yet to come. It's the playoffs.
Who will make it to the Premier League?
And who will be left heartbroken at Wembley?
Stay across it all with the second tier.
We're bringing you episodes after every leg.
And in between, we're revisiting the greatest moments in playoff history.
It's real conversation with two real championship obsessives.
So you can be in the know about everything happening in the playoffs.
And share all your new knowledge in the pub with your mates.
So come join us.
We're your one-stop shop for the playoffs.
Search second tier in your podcast app
and hit subscribe.
Welcome to On the Continent, your definitive guide to the week in European football. I'm Andy Brassel.
I'm Nikki Bandini.
And I'm David Cartledge.
On this edition, the vibes are so aged, it's like this year's Champions League final has been assembled by the Los Angeles Clippers recruitment department. Okay, it's not quite a facsimile of Wembley 2013. Hosolu's late show in Madrid put a stop to that. But there will be plenty of nostalgia in northwest London on the first day of June as Jude Bellingham comes up against his old pals. We'll also look at where 2020's finalists, Bayern Munich and Paris Saint-Germain, go next as they aim to carry on cleaning house. We're not forgetting the rest of UEFA club competition, of course. So we check in on Atalanta as they shine on all fronts under Giampiero Gasperini. Are we looking at just a great season or an absolutely historic one for the boys from Bergamo? Now, Thomas Tuchel put it after the first leg, David, that we were great for the first 15 minutes and then Real Madrid did to us what they do to everyone else. Now, the second part of that sentence, you can very much copy and paste. Could Bayern have done anything much different? Is there a total inevitability to what happened in the closing minutes of this semi-final?
There's an inevitability. To quote a famous meme, they can't keep getting away with this. But they keep getting away with it. There was an air of that again, once again, about Real Madrid. And I think a lot of people felt it as well. It wasn't the case of, oh, this might actually be the time that they get caught out here, that they can't, you know, go to that next level.
But you felt it, didn't you, Nicky?
Yeah, well, thinking of memes, I'm now thinking of that one with the guy with his head in the news saying first time, because I was watching with my brother and he said, oh, Bayern will score another here, won't they? And I'm like, first time watching Madrid in a European game? That's not how this goes. Yeah.
Well, was it less that it happened, but the manner in which it happened? Because Manuel Neuer was so assured. I said to some friends earlier, like from the first couple of minutes, I had this feeling, for me, the best Neuer game ever is Schalke away at Porto in 2010 in the last 16, which I think is the best performance from a goalkeeper I've ever seen in the flesh. And there was definitely that sort of presence about it. And that is why you might say, Nicky, that Real Madrid scoring late on is not a shock. Scoring in that way, David, was more of a shock and out of context with the rest of the game, right?
Yeah, I do. Honestly, I don't even think the atmosphere was too intense, but it is just the pressure cooker of being in the Bernabeu and a Champions League night. And it can get to everyone, even to somebody such as Neuer with his experience and such. And I think if you saw before that as well, like, again, now Tuchel has come out after and he said the subs that he made. So I think we have to focus on the subs because he took Musiala and Kane both off.
Yeah, that wow.
Yeah, that obviously reduces your outball and what you can do and to relieve pressure off your defence. Apparently there were injuries there. I think Kane had hurt his back, apparently, so he couldn't really run or walk anymore, so he went off. But it gives Real Madrid, or it gives an opponent at that stage, incentive. When you see those two players go off, there was no out ball there. They weren't able to stretch Real Madrid in any sense whatsoever.
So, and there's a symbolism to it as well, isn't there? Especially with Kane, right?
Absolutely. And Real Madrid look at that and go, all right, we can really pile the pressure on right now. We're not going to get caught by the legs of Musiala. We're not going to get caught by Kane's hold-up player. And Gnabry was already off as well. So it just, it's quite remarkable in terms of how much they handed, I think, the initiative to Real Madrid to say, all right, okay, come and break us down. And Real Madrid have enough players to do that. And they had threatened all game to do that.
It's really sort of hard to say with total clarity about that end of game situation, because Tuchel, at least in his post game comments, made it sound like there was injury issues at play there. And I think the Musiala situation perhaps more clear cut than Kane, where he sort of talked slightly vaguely about a back issue. I mean, it's tempting to look at Harry Kane afterwards having a go at the referee in injury time, looking quite animated and going, was he really? Because as far as 2 or 3 minutes left in normal time. Okay, in the end, we end up having about another extra time period worth of injury time. But would you at least not want to get him to the end of the 90?
I mean, on one hand...
He's your best penalty taker as well.
And so you're not saving him for anything else. There's nothing else you're keeping him for. Yeah.
That's right. On one hand, he wasn't helped off the pitch.
Yeah.
On the other hand, remember in the 2014 final, great Xabi Alonso ran on the pitch to celebrate when...
So I might be being uncharitable on that, and he may well have a real issue. I just you're so close to the end of the 90 at that point. I'm thinking, was he that urgently injured? Because he's such a good player to have in that phase of the game.
Yes,
he holds the ball up. He drops in and is able to play those release balls to the wide players. Also, just being honest about it, Harry Kane is very good at buying a foul and stopping the clock.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is all things that you could have done with in that moment.
Yeah, that's true. But really, we were focused on the other centre-forward, or the centre-forward that came on, Joselu. We're not going to go over the whole Stoke and Newcastle thing. That's too old. And he's done incredible things since. Yeah. You know, he's scored a lot of goals for not particularly good teams in the Spanish top flight. Here is an accomplished striker that they brought in to do a specific job. Spanish international, of course, now as well. But do you think, David, that the fact that Joselu ended up being the star in this is kind of symptomatic of Real Madrid's season, which, funnily enough, even though they've won the league by a mile, has not really been about stars, has it?
No, it hasn't. It hasn't really been a scintillating season. I thought they started really well. Obviously, they had a couple of months where it was very much Bellingham mania, and he was really carrying them a lot. If you really watch Real Madrid and you saw how much Bellingham was actually doing in those early months, and then he, I think, tailed off a little bit ever so slightly just due to fatigue and what have you as well.
But he's brilliant, but he's not a typical Madrid star player, is he?
No, not at all. And I mean, you could say in that team, there's probably Vinny, who is your quintessential Real Madrid star. And I thought he was fantastic, by the way. Although I thought he was really, really good, because I think we saw the previous night with Mbappe and not able to get in the game or influence the game. But Vinny finds a way to do it. I think Ancelotti set them up really nice. I noticed in the second half, he made sure that Vinny absolutely hugged that left-sided touchline. And what he did as well was made sure that Bellingham went close to him and other players as well. So there was always that support for Vinny. So he got the ball on the halfway line. There was always three or four Real Madrid shirts around him, just creating those overloads on the left side. And Bayern could not live with it. And that is where all their attacks generated from.
Yeah, Kimmich was all over the place as the second half went on, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. He had a bit of a Nuno Mendes against Jadon Sancho.
But do you think, from a UK perspective, do you think when we're talking about the best player in the world, which I think in the post-Ronaldo Messi era is kind of an open title, isn't it? You know, there are a few possible contenders, and I think that will change, and maybe it will get a bit clearer, come into focus over the next couple of years. Do you feel that over here we don't discuss Vinny enough with that as we might do?
I think so. I think he's generally seen as, I think in the UK, to a casual viewer, he's probably seen as some sort of Robinho type who dips in and out of games. And don't get me wrong, he has bad games, but when it comes down to it, a lot of the time, he really does deliver. And he caused so many problems last night. And he's very, very hard to shut down as well. There was a moment, I think there was one brilliant save from Neuer. And there was just quick feet from Vinny to cut inside. And it looked like he had no space whatsoever to get a shot away or able to generate any power. And he did. And he does things like that. And he can cause so many problems on that level when he's really focused. And you've got Rodrigo on the other side as well, who can also cause problems. So if you double up on Vinny, then you're leaving Rodrigo open as well.
Talking of the stars, Nicky, what about Jude Bellingham? Because, of course, he's in the final against his former club, fairy tale ending to his first season, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there has been a feeling, and when we're talking, we talked about this in the Ramble recently, the route to becoming the best player in the world. If you think of Messi and Ronaldo in the past, they've been accused of like ducking big games or not getting as involved as they might between big games. Mm. Of course, there was always that thing that Messi never scored against English teams until he did in the 2009 final against Manchester United at the best possible time. Bellingham he was more involved than he was in the first leg. Mm-hmm. But he's not as explosive as people are expecting. And he's not been throughout this Champions League knockout round. Is this part of his road to being, if not the best player in the world, one of the best players in the world, working out how to impact these biggest games? Or is it just not possible in modern football to be that consistent?
Yeah, I think there's so many things that go into it when you talk about a one-off game. I actually was thinking, I was curious, just as you were making that point a second ago about how Vinicius Junior is considered and whether he's treated like one of the world's best. I pulled up the Guardian's top 100 players from the last one was at the end of 2023 because I was curious because I couldn't remember how that finished. And Bellingham's number two and Vinny's number six. So he's still very much in
six.
That. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm pretty confident I had him higher. I can tell you who's ahead of him: Haaland, Bellingham, Mbappe, Kane, Rodri, and then Vinny Jr. So they are names that are, it's not totally like easy to go, well, he's obviously better than one of those. Those are all really top level players. You know, when you talk about an individual game, things come into it that are individual tactics for an individual game. And I think that it felt like there was a clear moment after half time where it's not just that Vinny Jr. is a good player. Ancelotti has given them some instructions to attack down that left-hand side. And it happens that Vinny Jr. is good enough to start getting the better of Kimmich in a way that very few players could. So things happen in games that are not just about how talented someone is. They're about game plans and about things that the coaches have seen during the break and that they've analysed and looked at. I don't know. I continue to be really impressed with Jude Bellingham. I don't think you've got to be, especially in this team, the standout every single game. And in fact, that's almost the story of this game, with Joselu being the one who scores the goals. And I think that the way he sort of spoke afterwards again, I just find it ridiculous how he's taking it all in his stride so easily. He just talks about it like, oh, well, you know, I was fascinated by this actually because he talked about it. I was like, oh, because he was already wearing his shirt with the number 15 on it.
And Paulo Sodesma. Yeah.
Because they're obviously going for the 15th Champions League win and saying, well, there's an expectation here. You know, you're expected to. And it never felt to me watching, and of course I was watching on TV, not in a stadium. It never felt to me like the Madrid crowd was raging at the sort of near miss. It felt like there was almost like this confidence and this sort of,
they were expecting it, like,
yeah, you. And I think he actually has really like taken that on, that same sort of big, you know, cliche though it is, big club mentality of, yeah, well, we're supposed to be here, we're supposed to win these games, and now we'll go and win the whole thing.
In terms of Bellingham though, I mean, are we seeing some sort of seem as we go on to the next part of Real Madrid? Because this season, I mean, obviously it could end in glorious fashion after they've already won the Super Cup in great style against Barcelona, La Liga, and now they're going, of course, for the Champions League. So it could be an incredible season, despite the fact that it's always had the feeling of being a little bit transitional, a little bit waiting for Mbappe. And this is something that Bellingham watchers are going to have to get used to, him not being the main billing when you have a team that's led, and it will be led, by Mbappe and by Vinicius, no?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, he's his role in this Real Madrid side, he's got two main duties, I think. Number one is to be kind of a conduit for that attack, to bring Vinny, to bring Rodrigo into play, make sure they've got that little link that just roams around in central areas and gives those players a platform to do what they do. And the second is, if he can get there as well, those late arrivals in the box, make sure he's just dropping in like that, the old Lampard way sort of thing, just being on the edge of the penalty area, just running in. Maybe
Brian Robson for the older generation.
Brian Robson for the old generation. So those are his two jobs. He does those really, really well. And now and then he has a big Bellingham moment where he does really impose himself on games and you see everything running through him, and also he will score or he will assist.
From that perspective, is this a one-off season? I don't want to say it's his only chance to win the Ballon d'Or, but maybe this season, particularly if England were to go on and win the Euros, for example, it feels to me as if this would be his best chance of winning the Ballon d'Or before we hit a new era.
Absolutely, because you're going to have three major personalities who are going to be in that Real Madrid team every week vying for top status. You're going to have Mbappe, Vinny and Bellingham. Those are three really big players, all probably in the top 10 in the world. For a lot of people, probably in the top 5 in the world. So this is a massive, massive amount of pressure for Bellingham. But again, as Nicky has said, he seems to take every single, you know, gauntlet that's thrown down to him in his stride, really. So I think he can do it. And of course, once he's finished with Real Madrid, he's going to have the pressure of an entire nation here about the Euros.
Well, there you go. We were starting off talking about the Clippers. We've worked out the Real Madrid are turning into Golden State next. Are we concerned, briefly?
I'm so at my depth with the NBA references. I have no idea.
I was going to say, Nicky, are we briefly concerned that Bayern are turning into the Los Angeles Lakers? All the glamour, but it's not really quite knitted together. I mean, they've got this prolonged manager search that, you know, we've heard Erik ten Hag linked with the job this week. And that makes sense to a certain extent because he's got history at the club and he's respected there. Though I don't really fancy him as the man to sort out their shambolic defence. I mean, we talk about holding patterns. They need major surgery if they're to be back here on a regular basis, don't they?
I think it's a really difficult season to analyse now for Bayern Munich because they've been so far behind Bayer Leverkusen in the Bundesliga. But Bayer Leverkusen have been ridiculous. I mean, they're 47 games undefeated.
Higher points total than last season, Bayern.
Yeah.
Already, yeah.
So realistically, I think Bayern have certainly sort of let their standards drop a bit in this last part of the season because they know that's gone anyway. And yet, actually, they did still, while we, including me, can joke about, of course, Real Madrid are going to score, they always do. In the end, they were a couple of minutes away from knocking Real Madrid out in the semi-final of the Champions League. And Thomas Tuchel, whatever else he's got wrong, has got this Champions League run, the individual games, right a lot more than he's got wrong. And that's going to be hard to replace. You have to find a manager because different managers bring you different things. And I think probably regardless of this run, you did need to change Tuchel just because it has felt like for a significant part of the season, for want of a better way of putting it, the vibe has been very negative around Bayern.
A lot of internal issues there, clearly.
And so you need to bring in someone who can change that. But are you going to get someone who is, on the flip of that, as tactically astute and able to put his team in a position to knock out Real Madrid, even if they couldn't quite get across the line? Because there was a lot right in this. They did play a very canny first half in which really we didn't see a lot of anything from Real Madrid. They did get themselves 1-0 up, and at 1-0, they had chance to put it away. I certainly wouldn't blame Harry Kane because the season he's had, but he had a chance at 1-0 to make it 2-0. And if he scores that, then we're not here talking about Real Madrid going through.
Of course, the Champions League, as always, covers a multitude of sins, which takes us on to Borussia Dortmund. Now, Bayern might not have kept up their side of the bargain in terms of recreating Wembley 2013, but 11 years on, Marco Reus is going to be playing his last game for Dortmund in the place where he finished his first season for Dortmund. Of course, he's not renewing his contract at the end of the season in what appears a mutual decision between player and club. We'll come on to Reus in a little bit as a footnote. But how much of an achievement is this, particularly after the way Dortmund have had a very, very up and down season? The beneficiaries of course, that fifth place in the Champions League. Otherwise, they might need to be winning it at Wembley to get back in it, which they won't have to do. Obviously, they would like to. How much do we need to put this in the context of the way that last season finished? Mm-hmm. The way that they had their hearts broken on the final day of the season when they had the Bundesliga title in their hands. They let it slip. It's a remarkable story, isn't it? The fact that in the league, they've been a total mess. And in the Champions League, they couldn't have planned it any better, could they?
Yeah, I think lesser clubs, lesser teams could have been in a permanent hangover this entire season and said, look, we've simply not recovered from the way that you know, played out on the final day of the season.
It could have been worse, couldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a significant achievement. And, you know, I think we've both had our criticisms and questions of Terdic on this podcast, on this very podcast.
Yeah, there's plenty of time for that.
Yeah. There's still a couple. But I think the way that he has kind of tightened this group together and lifted them on the back of that, but also in terms of their domestic season, to produce these level of performances in the Champions League has been outstanding. The players clearly love him, clearly love his personality. You see him on the touchline and the way he is, and as a player, you will warm to that, absolutely. And they had a very, very clear game plan against PSG in both legs, and it was executed perfectly. I watched those two games back, and I know PSG, a lot was said about how many times they hit the woodwork and what have you. But I don't think Dortmund were really completely up against the cosh at any point in terms of...
It was never a deluge, you know, was it?
How many saves did Kobel really have to make? Mm. You know, he wasn't really up against it, like, say, Neuer, what we saw from Neuer last night, who made several key saves. Mm. It was a different context of game, I thought. So I think for Terdic to stick to that, and then... There was always, again, and we've discussed this about Bayern, there was always an outball for Dortmund as well. Mm. If you look at Brandt especially, I thought he was remarkable across the game and Schlotterbeck. But if you look at the players like Sancho, Brandt, they were always an outball. They were always dangerous on the attack. There was always that danger for PSG. And I thought that was interesting that Terdic allowed Dortmund to create that.
Yeah, and Nicky, we talked a lot about Dortmund being... high quality individuals trumping the lack of system for a lot of the time. But the buy-in that Edin Terzic got from these individuals, I mean, do you think this like puts like a full stop to the fact that we just have to accept that he's just a better cup manager? Maybe.
Maybe. I don't know. Sometimes I still come back to the old thing about it's that cartoon of two sports analysts sat when one of them saying the random number generators produce another set of random numbers. Let's create a narrative around it. And sometimes I do think there are things that happen because it is true when you hit the woodwork that many times that if one of those goes in, you have a completely different story to this match. You just do. But having said that, I don't know. I almost sort of think when I'm, if I don't want to do that and I want to talk about the things, because Dortmund obviously did do lots of things great, and I actually do agree with you that despite hitting the woodwork a lot, there was a lack of that sort of head of steam moment. Actually, you could contrast it with Real Madrid, where even though this isn't when their goal came, there was a period at 0-0 where Real Madrid really were building up a head of steam and you felt like, okay, this is now a team that is on top.
For a lot of that first half, actually. Yeah.
Whereas PSG, I'm not sure how much that really felt like it happened. But there are individual players in this Dortmund team like Mats Hummels, you just want to look at and go, well, some of this, and perhaps to some extent, I think this whole Champions League campaign, there's been a few examples of this. Older, smart players who are exerting the power of their sort of wisdom and experience on these stages that I think is perhaps not been talked enough about enough. I think Hummels for Dortmund, to a lesser extent, perhaps Sabitzer as well, really controlling influence all through the tournament, I think. There's just been a few players with that know-how.
The point about Hummels is really interesting, actually, because I think you'd almost put him now in the Luka Modric bracket of players who are better now than they were like 3 years ago, despite the fact that they may be more celebrated then. I mean, there's every possibility that maybe Hummels, if Dortmund win in the final or if they don't win in the final, that he walks away at the end of this, that he calls it quits with professional football. And to me, he's like, say, obviously there's a lot of fanfare around Marco Reus, and he deserves it. He's done a lot for his hometown club. He's done a lot for the community there, which is not always acknowledged. But with Hummels, I mean, it's almost as if he's learned in the last couple of years, he will be going out at the absolute peak of his powers, I think, when he goes. Mm-hmm. Because it's almost as if his experience has enabled him to cope with his lack of pace. And of course, we'll end up talking about his goal from the second leg. And he's a great threat in the box. It was almost a like Thiago Silva-esque, like, because he's got that that wisdom, that technical ability to finish as well. And we saw that with the way he mugged Beraldo off for the goal. But really, it was the challenge in the first half from a very, very difficult angle that prevented a certain goal that was maybe his key moment of the game and shows how good he still is.
That was the big moment in the game for me, and I tweeted about this straight away after, and I said it felt like everything could have changed. And I genuinely thought if that had gone in, I think PSG might have stuck 3 or 4 on because Dortmund would have had to have done something then. It would have been the game would have become a bit more fragmented. Whereas they were able to just sit back after, due to that, they were able to sit back and kind of soak that pressure up and then break when they could. So yeah, I think that moment was huge, and Hummels really was excellent. Like you say, he was.
I just think it's fascinating how little the game even happened down that side of the pitch. You think that's Mbappe's side of the pitch,
yeah.
And Hummels and Ryerson, but especially Hummels, just really felt like they just occupied that area, and so we didn't see Mbappe.
Yeah, Ancelotti created a game state for Vinicius, as we've just been discussing. Mm. Whereas Luis Enrique didn't seem to do that. A lot went elsewhere. It was Dembele definitely had the ball.
Has he mismanaged Mbappe over the last couple of months? Do you think?
I think so, and I think it goes back to potentially a hint of a point that you've made several times in terms of that PSG's wanting to learn to play without him. I just didn't think now was the time. I think you can handle that in pre-season.
You do that in the summer, can't you?
Yeah. You really can. And so that was a strange comment from, and I'm a really big fan of Luis Enrique as well, as you know. But that was a bit of a strange comment and a bit of a strange way to approach things when there was still so much on the line. They still had that thing that hangs over PSG as a club. Mm. They want to be, you know, that they've done very well, quarterfinals, semifinals, and what have you like that in the QSI era. But look, they haven't reached that final and they still haven't cemented that. Chelsea obviously did that when they won the Champions League and they said, look, we're here. Well, yes, we're backed by this money, but right, okay, we're sitting at the table right now. We're here. And that really, really stamps where you are as a club when you do that. And PSG is still waiting for that. And they're still seen as just a little bit of a joke.
I think that's the funny thing, isn't it? If you'd have said at the start of this season, talking of transition and rebuilds and all that sort of stuff, because they're entering the post-Neymar and Messi era, if you'd have said at the start of the season that they get to the Champions League final, semi-final, to me that feels quite acceptable. It's just the fact that they went out to a really quite beatable Dortmund team that's the issue. And I think the funny thing is, we're talking about what Terzic did really well in this. And in terms of drilling the wide players to do so much work. If you look at what Sancho and Adeyemi did in that first leg. Now Sancho didn't have quite the same impact in the second leg, but you talked about getting that support to Kylian Mbappe, for example. Now, whether Luis Enrique's managed him right, we can come back to that. I think that's a different question. But it felt to me that Sancho was living in the head of Nuno Mendes a little bit. He was like, rather than you want him to attack, you know, he's someone who was a wing back when he was at Sporting, for example, and that's why he caught the eye. That's why PSG wanted to buy him. But he looked at that almost as if, right, this guy's made me look an idiot a couple of times. I'm going to defend him properly. But that has implications in terms of what you take away from the attack, doesn't it?
Of course it does. That's in the back of your head now. So you think, oh, I can't push on. I can't really push on ahead of our advanced midfielder now. And he had one effort that struck the woodwork, of course. I think everybody in that PSG team did. So he was obviously concerned about that. And like you say, it doesn't. So when Mbappe does cut in as he does, there was that big empty space down there. So Dortmund were like, oh, right, we can easily defend that. Be aware, we can have one man over there. We don't need to double up over there anymore. Mbappe was just Mbappe was always cropping up in areas where Dortmund had a numerical advantage. And don't get me wrong, Mbappe is so good and so quick with his feet that he was able to get crosses out and some shots as well. He is that good. But he was generally managed well by Dortmund and not managed well by his own coach.
And perhaps that's when, just to bring it back, because I feel like people might listen and think, I know there's some conspiracy that we really don't like Edin Terzic here. I should say that I perhaps was uncharitable there by putting all of that on Hummels and Ryerson and not saying that, look, some of that doubling up, some of that having Sancho hold that high position, that's the manager as well.
I mean, I think you're allowed to criticise him for the season. I mean, you know, they've got the second biggest budget after Bayern in the Bundesliga. They've got a much bigger budget than Leverkusen, who have showed us what is possible, actually, with great coaching, great recruitment, great player management, all this sort of stuff. But this is Dortmund's moment, and they did brilliantly over this tie. But the way that Terzic judged it, tactically, his subs, everything, did it kind of shine a little bit on what Luis Enrique did wrong? Because I think you looked at the first leg, Gonzalo Ramos, I think, would have been a real plus, and me and JJ were talking about that last week. They brought him in here. He got himself in the spot a couple of times. And then when they needed a goal, they took him off and they put on Asensio, who I understand Asensio's got a lot of ability, but what does he really do?
Who has been taken off in previous games in this competition because that wasn't working.
Mm.
So, but I've watched.
They're still lacking a focal point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bit,
and I look at it, and again, I'm a big. I'm going to actually state I am a big fan of Luis Enrique, but I look back in this competition at every single game that they've had, and there's been issues early on in terms of figuring out, or kind of like, oh, I think we've set up wrong, and they've had to make changes. I'm going to go back to the Real Sociedad game. For 20, 25 minutes, they were really under the cosh against Real Sociedad, and Real Sociedad wasted quite a lot of chances.
I think the Newcastle game in the groups is one everyone will look at, where he stuck with a failing system for too long.
Exactly. And then he adjusted second half against Real Sociedad. And then, but he tried several ways to readjust, but nothing really had a pattern or a fluidity to it. So you can make changes, but it's a case of what you do with those changes and where they operate. Asensio didn't make any sense whatsoever to me. But Bagala, of course, I absolutely got. He'd been the danger man, I think, in the two previous games as well. So I understood that, but this is going back a tail over time with PSG, no matter what the coaches, no matter what the players. There is never a fluidity or a pattern to them. It just feels like the attackers are stuck up there and the midfield doesn't really have much rhyme or reason to it. They're just kind of, they say, they are told, get the ball to the creative players. But it's about how we get it and what ways you get there.
Yeah, it does feel a little bit like a team that's broken into segments.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's three different segments, absolutely.
And I can't tell you, Nicky, on French telly, how much Samir Nasri, of course, as a former Marseille player and Marseille boy, enjoyed standing there on the touchline saying, oh, they totally lacked intensity. They were terrible. Forget the shots that hit the crossbar and the post and all that sort of stuff. But when we look at this campaign for PSG as a whole, they're not a million miles away from a quadruple, because we can react so emotionally to these incredibly emotional Champions League games, and because PSG or PSG. Mm-hmm. Is there a danger they throw the baby out with the bathwater here, where actually Luis Enrique's done quite a lot of positive work and they are coming through like a total culture change?
I mean, on the one hand, I completely understand where you're coming from. On the other hand, barring some shocking twist...
Are you Team Samir?
No, just that next season, you're saying goodbye to 26 goals in the league, 8 goals in the Champions League from Kylian Mbappe. So... what happens next? When we talk about the positives, yes, the team has felt a lot more rational at times this season than perhaps we've seen in the past, where it's just always felt like a bit of a basket case situation with I don't know, too many cooks. But the reality is you are saying goodbye to one of the best players in the world. And do I think that everything else in this team is so good that you're going to just keep winning? I don't feel like that at the moment. So I do understand where you're coming from. And I also am quite a fan of Luis Enrique, but I don't look at this team and think, oh, they're going to be just fine. I think you've got a big problem coming up.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Now, not that PSG would ever take this kind of advice, but maybe they could take a leaf out of the book of Giampiero Gasperini if we're talking about falling out with superstars and moving on from them. I mean, they are going into the Europa League semi-final second leg tonight in Bergamo against Marseille, having drawn the away leg. You may well have seen this already, so you might have a little bit ahead of us by the time you listen to this. Gasperini did say that the Europa League was their priority when we go back a week or so. But they've got a lot of other stuff on their plate. They've got the Coppa Italia final coming up against Juventus. And they had a really important win that people might have missed on Monday night at Salernitana to get them into the top five. Top five, of course, is a Champions League place in Italy this season, as we've said before. Yeah. So there are a lot of probables and possibles for them.
Top six may well be a Champions League spot because of Atalanta, because if either of they or Roma
miss the top five and win
no Europa even if League. They're in the top five,
yeah, even if they win, of course, yeah,
we actually had this clarified for us on my Italian football podcast I do. The UEFA have clarified that if either of those teams finish in the top five and win the Europa League, they get the Europa League spot, and so that then vacates the spot that is either the the fifth plus base spot or the top four spot. So in either case, that is what would happen.
We're talking about a busy next season for you.
Yeah, well, I'd say the chances of Roma winning the Europa League are looking fairly distant at this time recording. People may be listening and going, oh, she hasn't seen the 4-0 win over Bayer Leverkusen
at the time of recording.
but it's looking unlikely. So It is mostly Atalanta. Yeah, it's been fascinating, the journey that Gasperini's been on in terms of what matters most to him this season, because pretty much all through the campaign, he said it in January, he said it in February, he said it in March, said it even at the start of this month, the Coppa Italia is the priority. That's the one we can win. I want this trophy. And understandably, he wants something to crown this extraordinary chapter he's had at the club. But basically, pretty much just at the start of the semi-finals, he looked around and said, well, all right, yeah, now we think we actually might have a chance to win it. So now this has clearly taken over and it's captured the imagination. You're talking about a club that's never played in a European final. Of course, this is the one that means the most to them now. And it's tantalizingly close. I think whatever happens, this is going to have been an extraordinary season for them. But of course, when you get this close to something you've never done in your history, it's what you want. You want that even more than being in the Champions League next season. You want to be in a European final.
And we talk about the successful teams in these European competitions this season. And, you know, we've talked again and again about Leverkusen, their flexibility that enables them to finish games strongly. To a lesser level, that's what Atalanta have got as well, haven't they? I mean, I don't think you necessarily look at them and think, right, okay, that's my Gala 11, and then you have the rest of the players. There are horses for courses there, aren't there?
It's just what they do on the pitch, what they do off the pitch as well, and that is they readapt and evolve, and they consistently do that. They have to do it because they lose players for whatever reason. They bring in other players as well, and Gasperini always shows that he can do that with new players and older players. And then here we see on the pitch as well, the way that he does it, he's a phenomenal coach. And I think if you look at his achievements, even outside of trophies, I think if you really get down to it and see what he has been doing, it would be lovely to see him get a trophy, I think, and have this moment in the limelight. Because I think he had that, you know, I know he had that opportunity at Inter as well. And there was a lot
Can you call four games an opportunity?
So
that's more of an intermission.
Yeah, intermission. So, I mean, he did. He had that big opportunity at Inter and that didn't work out for a variety of reasons. And I think this is now his chance to get that trophy. And I don't know, I kind of always view Gasperini as a Euro Bielsa of sorts.
Yes.
This brilliant philosopher, this brilliant mind, yet he just needs that, you know, that thing to cement. And I'd love to see him get a trophy.
Yeah, and he was sort of talking about this idea of, you know, it's pretty much his best season already because of where they are. But I mean, this is still someone who went top three since being appointed by Atalanta in 2016. He's taken them to the top three three times, top four another time, and was in the years when Italy wasn't getting itself a Champions League spot for fourth place, unfortunately. But he's done that. They were moments away in the pandemic season behind closed doors of knocking out PSG and going to the semi-final of the Champions League. So he's had some extraordinary moments, but it is just missing something tangible. And that's the thing. Even if they have gone out by the time you listen to this, if they go and win the Coppa Italia, that would still be beyond anyone's expectations at the start of the season. But of course, like I just said, it's a European final. They want it.
But when you talk about the near misses and the achievements over recent years, I think that's really what Gasperini is about, isn't it? That, like, the fact that it's been such a sustained period of success for Atalanta. So if I were to ask you, you know, is this his best ever Atalanta team? It's kind of the wrong question, isn't it, really? Yeah. Because it's his ability to turn over, lose players, as you always will when you're a club of that size, and to constantly rebuild and keep it all going. That's the amazing bit, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You think about who've been the most important players this season. Right now it's Gianluca Scamacca, who is on some previously unimaginable tear in front of goal. I mean, he cannot stop scoring, and scoring brilliant goals, by the way, as well. He's gone in the space of 3 months from being an abstract idea of maybe he could end up playing up front for Italy to now, even though he wasn't called up for the last round of international duty. I think a lot of Italians are going, this has to be our number nine at the Euros, because he's the Italian forward who's scoring goals by the bucket load. So you look at him, you look at Koop Meiners, who's been exceptional.
Incredible, yeah.
But there's been phases of this season when there have been different players who've been to the fore. Charles de Ketelaar had a period of the season when he was absolutely carrying
the team.
Lookman, who I think lately is actually having a bit of a struggle. He just looks like a guy who's trying to do too much.
Mm.
But there's been periods of the season when he's been brilliant. And that's the great success of Atalanta. It's a great success of their recruiting. But I actually think, above all, when we talk about Gasperini, it's not just about him. He deserves all credit that comes to him, because he is a brilliant manager who deals with this rotating cast. But I think actually what you see at Atalanta is symbiosis between club and manager. It's also why he hasn't left.
Mm.
Because every now and then you've heard him get frustrated about things, say, I need clarity from the ownership about where we're going, what we're trying to do.
But you don't get that power or status anywhere else.
But every time they...
You're just the coach.
Every time they've engaged with him about it, every time they have listened to him, they've said, all right, well, what do you need? What do you want? What are we trying to do? And it's always been collaborative. And you just don't see that, I don't think, in that many clubs, this long-term willingness of ownership and manager to make sure they're on the same page and that they're working towards the same thing.
If you'll allow me to be completely vulgar for 1 minute, David, if you're a scout or a sporting director... We've heard about Liverpool, or more specifically Arne Slot's interest in 10 Koop Meiners, for example, and you can understand why that is. Who are you looking at if you're a sporting director or a scout to take off them in the summer?
Scalvini.
Yeah?
Yeah. I think he's phenomenal. I think he's outstanding. I think a lot of people might have I think he's very similar in a way at the Bastoni, and I think people might have a little bit of doubts because of Bastoni's a little slightly older.
Mm.
Where they can have with Scalvini, I think a prospect for the next 10, 12 years. I think he's a phenomenal defender. I really like everything about him.
Anything to add, Nikki?
Scalvini's brilliant. Oh, I definitely think he's a big name. I think Koop Meiners will likely go, and wherever he goes, I think he'll be a success because he's a brilliant footballer. I think that perhaps, I don't think if he'll ever leave now, but I think Darun has quietly just kept that engine ticking so well that he deserves to be named and praised a bit sometimes as well. But Scalvini's, if you're looking for a 20-year-old talent who's got everything ahead of him, yeah, great.
Yeah, if there's a reason to save X/Twitter, it's Martin Deroen, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
After all that, well, it feels like none of these games of the week will be any better than the games that we've just seen. But look, we have to be optimistic and say there will be great games this weekend. Come on, I know you've got a good one, Nikki.
Yeah, well, it's Atalanta Roma. So you've got this peculiar moment, which they've both been building up to these European semi-finals, and then they've been knowing they're going to play each other in the league. And as we've just touched on, they might be in a situation where one of them helps the other one to qualify for the Champions League because of the opportunity to win the cup. Between the two of them, I certainly feel like Atalanta are in a better shape at the moment. There's something about Roma, they just feel like they've perhaps hit the wall a little bit, and then they're running out of steam at the end of this season. That early new manager wave from De Rossi maybe has started to fade a little bit as well. But this is still a big game in that fight for the top five spots, and we don't know that one of them's going to win the Europa League, so it could be everything. That's the game. I know I have to do a food pairing.
Yeah, you do. I've just had a message from Mr. D. Adebayo who said, don't leave my stomach empty.
I know. I always feel so much pressure with Dutton to make sure it's something worthy of it.
Consider that pressure conveyed.
It's in Bergamo, so it's got to be polenta in some format. And I'm going to go with something I've actually never tried, but I was sore earlier and thought, oh, now I want to try it, which is lasagna made with polenta sheets instead of the traditional pasta sheets. Oh. So using polenta in the flour to...
Really?
To, wow. Yeah, make a little polenta sandwich. It sounds heavy, but I'm curious. My interest is piqued, so I'm going to put that in and we'll find out.
Right, as long as you can eat it over a number of days, I think, because
it's going to be
we're getting that hitting that weather. We're moving away from heavy food.
I know that's my one thought, but I was too intrigued not to.
I want you to bear that in mind with your food choice, David. What's your game?
All right, so Real Mallorca has had one cup final this season already, which they lost, and they've got another one on Saturday, at 1 o'clock against Las Palmas. Las Palmas haven't won in 7 games, but Real Mallorca really need to win this one to secure their top flight status. And it not be a season where they made the cup final, but they were relegated. So there's like a lot of pressure here, I think, on Javier Aguirre. So another cup final for Mallorca. And it seems though we are in Mallorca. We've got to go for Sobrasada, if you can get it, if you can find it. Very sort of like a sausage type paste.
Okay.
And that you just stroke on bread.
Sort of a bit like Andouja.
Yeah, kind of like that. Yeah, right. Kind of like that. Absolutely shocking for your cholesterol, but do you know what I mean? We're in a relegation dogfight here. You need
Everyone
something to get
you feeling
through.
Tense anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a long trip back to Gran Canaria as well, isn't it? I'm going to quickly chuck in Rennes versus Lens on Sunday. A lot of European implications to that. And while we're on the sausage tip, of course, JJ wouldn't forgive me if I didn't talk about the galette saucisse that you get in that part of the world. Thanks so much for joining us and for listening to On the Continent. Make sure you join us again tomorrow for Ask OTC, where we'll be answering all of your questions about the latest news from the world of European football. And make sure to subscribe in your podcast app so you never miss an episode. Welcome to On the Continent, your definitive guide to the week in European football. I'm Andy Brassel.
And I'm Nikki Bandini.
And I'm David Cartledge.
Oh, you didn't and there.
I know, I did. I got it wrong. I'm so used to being number three in the order after Dotton and Andy that I just threw an and out. I couldn't help it.
Okay, well, should I first say congratulations on your promotion up the order?
I'm in the Andy Brassel seat. I'm nervous. I don't know if I'm ready for it.
On the Continent is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.